The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Thank you. I would like to thank you for coming today, and I would like to thank the Office of the State Historian for giving me this opportunity to present my work and also for supporting my work through research in the archives. The immediate focus of today's discussion is the travel narrative, El Gringo, New Mexico and Her People, published in 1857. As the title implies, the book is a juxtaposition of identities. On one side of the colon, we read the author looking at himself through the eyes of the other, and opposite that, the suggestion of a far more epistemic mission, of offering knowledge of that same other to his readers by way of his description. Ostensibly, it was a travel narrative. However, Davis, unlike other writers, was acting as an agent of the U.S. government, as a newly appointed U.S. attorney, given the task of imposing the U.S. legal system in the New Mexican territory. Within a broader framework, this project explores El Gringo as an example of the relationship between language and power during the pivotal mid-19th century. Davis's impulse to identify both the land and the people was a discursive response to a compelling challenge to the nation's collective identity. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, signed at the end of the U.S.-Mexican War, marked a drastic reconfiguration of both nations. Between 1846 and 1848, Mexico lost nearly half of its land holdings, and as a result, the U.S. gained a region 2.5 times the size of France. And from this, I'd like to kind of give you a geographic perspective of what we're looking at. These are maps showing the not-so-gradual expansion of the U.S. territory between the time of 1775, the time of this map, and of course we can see the 13 original colonies clustered against the Atlantic Ocean. This is the Mexican Republic as of 1821, at the time of its independence from Spain. So it's quite a huge landmass. At the time of 1810, this shows the Louisiana Purchase, which was size of the United States increased to about, it looks like, 2/3 of what we now know of as the United States. And there in the western corner is what would largely become ceded as part of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848. And this, I don't know, I guess you probably can't see this too well. This is a map of the territory of New Mexico that was, I guess, commissioned under the order of General Kearney when he arrived in New Mexico in 1846. And this is an interesting map because it is so vague in the sense, I don't know if you've seen maps like from medieval times or earlier, where it shows the world and there's this huge unknown. And so that's kind of how it is with the Navajo Indians. So way over to the left side of the page is what would have been what we now think of as Arizona, the Navajo Indian territory. And it shows, of course, the Rio Grande. Some of the only landmarks are really the Rio Grande River and some of the mountain peaks. The U.S.-Mexican War lasted 2 years, from 1846 to 1848, and was fought mainly in Mexico. Arguably, Santa Fe was taken by Kearney without bloodshed.
Once the armed conflict had ended, the real work of imposing U.S. rule in New Mexico took place not by force, but through language. As an example, I'd like to look at a couple of excerpts from the Kearny Proclamation. The second paragraph begins with this first bullet. The undersigned has come to New Mexico with a strong military force, and an equally strong one is following close in his rear. He has more troops than necessary to put down any opposition that can possibly be brought against him, and therefore it would be but folly or madness for any dissatisfied or discontented persons to think of resisting him. Notice how Kearny refers to himself in the third person, presenting himself with a near absolute authority. Rather than presenting himself as the agent of an abstract governmental body, he focuses on power as emanating from a strong individual leader who is physically present. This may have been particularly effective rhetorically, considering that Mexico's leadership had deteriorated drastically under Santa Anna, and that a primary weakness of the Mexican government in their northern regions was due to the fact that they weren't present, particularly as a military force to protect the New Mexicans from hostile Indians. The second bullet expresses the principal political objective of the proclamation, which was to impose martial law. And that is, the undersigned hereby absolves all persons residing within the boundaries of New Mexico from any further allegiance to the Republic of Mexico, and hereby claims them as citizens of the United States. Those who remain quiet and peaceable will be considered good citizens and receive protection. Those who are found in arms or instigating others against the United States will be considered as traitors and treating accordingly. And I don't know what the penalty for being a traitor was at that point, but I know at other points in U.S. history, the penalty has been death. And considering that, one day the Nuevo Mexicanos were Mexican citizens, the next day they were declared citizens of the U.S., and any type of resistance on their part could have been punishable by death. I think that I can't imagine a more rhetorically powerful statement than that. Okay, I'd like to move into my research approach, and I'd like to point out that it's primarily interdisciplinary. And it largely stems from critical discourse analysis, which endeavors to reveal power relationships that are frequently obfuscated and hidden, and then to derive results from them which are also of practical relevance. Critical discourse analysis pretty much comes from a European school, from scholars Tune Van Dyke, Norman Fairclough, Ruth Wodak, Gunther Kress, and others. Key to this study is the importance of travel writing. And travel writing was particularly significant rhetorically during the time of colonialism. And for that reason, I look to genre studies. And Carolyn Miller defines genre as more than a means of classifying types of literature. And I think that's how we think of it. We think of, okay, it's the genre of spy novels or something like that. But it really is a collection of formal and substantive features that work to elicit a particular situated effect on an audience. The formal features or standard conventions of genre provide the reader with a basis for what to expect from a text and how to experience it. Thus, the audience is prepared to anticipate, to be gratified, and to respond in a certain way. Some of these other terms I'm going to talk about a little bit more, but also colonial studies figure heavily into my project. Critical discourse analysis has been very much influenced by sociolinguistics. And then the discourse historical approach is what I'm using in my dissertation, And that's a more specific, focused type of critical discourse analysis. It's something that Ruth Wodak developed. And it focuses more on history and politics. And that's a large part of the significance of the archives for me in terms of building a greater political context for the discourse analysis. The parameters of this project limit the documents mainly to the period between the 1830s and 1860. As research progressed, this became more difficult as the range of relevance seemed to expand. As I started to see the connections between the different documents, and as they continued to move forward in time, it was harder to maintain that. And I think in my dissertation, I may have to rethink that quite a bit, because it's too difficult to impose set limitations on any type of time limitations on a study of discourse, largely because there's so much intertextuality involved. And part of the rationale for the time limitation is that the public attention began to focus more on American Indian issues and the sectionalist controversy. The fallout from the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was relatively obscure in my findings in terms of public discourse, meaning in newspapers, in the legislative records, and so forth. So I'd like to go over some key terms. All of these are terms that have different meanings and common usage that are accepted. But in terms of my project, what I mean in terms of discourse is language used in speech and writing as a form of social practice. The term practice suggests that discourse is socially constituted as well as socially shaped. It constitutes situations, objects of knowledge, social identities, and relationships between people and groups of people. And rhetoric is particularly controversial in terms of the meaning, you know, when you think about it and how it's used in the news and so forth. And it has both theoretical and practical implications. It refers to the analytic ability to see how language functions persuasively, as well to apply these means in specific situations. Rhetoric, according to Lloyd Bitzer, is inherently pragmatic for working as a mode of altering reality by the creation of discourse which changes reality through the mediation of thought and action. And rhetoric itself is morally neutral. And then the rhetorical situation is conceptualized as more than a context that exists for the purpose of explanation. It is the situation which calls discourse into existence. Bitzer asserts that a work is rhetorical because it is a response to a situation of a certain kind. And thus these works obtain their character from the circumstances of the historic context in which they occur. And again, this emphasizes the importance of the historical context and the value of archival sources in continually enriching this understanding. Another key term is intertextuality. And this term, in how I use it, builds on the work of Bakhtin, and I've adopted Charles Bazerman's definition, describing intertextuality as the explicit and implicit relations that a text or utterance has to prior, contemporary, and potential future texts. All factions involved in the struggle over land during the territorial period had an entire cultural history behind them, each culminating in a different perspective regarding entitlement and the rule of law. Both Mexicanos and Anglo-Americans drew on their wealth of inherited collective texts in order to fix an ideological position from which they could assert their right to the land and its resources. In El Gringo, intertextuality works on several levels, including references to other texts, specific content shared with other texts, and the deployment of rhetorically useful tropes behind long-held cultural beliefs. It wasn't until fairly recently that scholars recognize the pragmatic implications of travel writing as discourse, focusing not on its historical data per se, but on the ideological influences of its production. Regarding travel narratives focusing on the Southwest, New Mexico and the Southwest, the popularity began in the 16th century. In 1542, Francisco Núñez Cabeza de Vaca published Relaciones y Comentarios in Spain, recounting his odyssey during one of the first Spanish expeditions. This was followed by Gaspar Pérez de Villagra's account of the 1580 Oñate expedition, the history of Mexico, published in Madrid in 1610. And I have a copy of that here that I'd like to pass around. This is one of my favorites of the era. It really isn't contemporaneous with the other books that were published during Davis's time, but this is composed of cantos. And when it was evaluated in Spain, the poetry wasn't particularly appreciated. They didn't think it was very good poetry, but just that anyone would try to construct a history written in this form, to me, is very impressive. And this is the English translation. Oh, that's the book by Villagra. The History of New Mexico. Okay, another one which I don't have with me today is Gregg's Commerce of the Prairies. And this was a bestseller in 1861. It sold 300,000 copies. It was a source of Davis's information, and it underwent 14 printings, six in the author's lifetime, and was also printed in Germany and England. Other popular books included Albert Pike's Prose Sketches and Poems Written in the Western Country, George Wilkins Kendall's Narrative of the Texas Santa Fe Expedition, Thomas James' 3 Years Among the Indians and Mexicans, and James O. Patty's The Personal Narrative of James O. Patty of Kentucky. And again, I'd like to emphasize that none of these other authors were direct representatives of the interests of the United States like Davis was. So even though if you look at the somehow I ended up with two copies checked out of the Kindle expedition. I have to stay closer to the microphone. Given the colonial environment during the 19th century, travel narratives were often as much a hegemonic discourse as the account of an individual's travels. The act of naming and identifying what was new for the benefit of the reader assumed a privileged position on the part of the narrator, one that Pratt has termed the monarch of all I survey. Okay. Ironically, from this outsider's perspective, as we see in bullet number 2, the narrator must make significant his or her own discoveries of what is and has been commonplace for natives of that region. And one of Davis's descriptions of Santa Fe, he writes, "You see stretching before you on both sides of the little river of the same name a cluster of flat-roofed mud houses, which in the distance you can hardly distinguish from the earth itself." Pratt notes that arrival scenes are a common convention of travel writing as a whole, serving as particularly potent sites for framing relations of contact and setting the terms of its representation. Note Davis's choice of imagery as he sets the scene for his Anglo-Protestant readers. On being set down a stranger in a strange land, I do not deny that I had the feeling common to all in a similar situation. And for a time, that heart malady called homesickness made a lodgment in an unoccupied corner of my heart. To a greater or lesser degree, this feeling will seize upon all comers from the United States when they place foot in Santa Fe for the first time. The whole aspect of things is so entirely different from what they have been accustomed to. A foreign language salutes their ears, a strange race of men gape at them without a particle of sympathy, and the mud city with its dirty streets and no less dirty population all presents such an uninviting picture to the stranger that in spite of all he can do, he will feel a little down in the mouth. But if it were not for the circumstances under which the traveler first enters Santa Fe, he would be tempted to leave again in disgust ere the sound of his footfall had died away in the streets. The rhetorical strategy used in writing the previous passage is clearer if we consider it in terms of choices, particularly if we compare them to those made by other writers concerning the same subject. Albert Pike's arrival scene seems to have served as the model for what Davis would write several years later, but with notable differences. Pike states, to an American, the first sight of these New Mexican villages is novel and singular. He seems taken into a different world. Everything is new, strange, and quaint. The men with their pantalones of cloth, gaily ornamented with lace, split up on the outside of the leg to the knee and covered at the bottom with a broad strip of morocco. The jacket of calico, the botas of stamped and embroidered leather, the zarape or blanket of striped red and white, the broad-brimmed hat with black silk handkerchief tied round it in a roll, or in the lower class, the simple attire of breeches of leather reaching only to the knees, a shirt and a zarape, the bonnetless women with silken scarf or red shawl over their heads, and added to all the continual chatter of Spanish about him, all remind him that he is in a strange land. The idea of strangeness is common to both Pike and Davis, but Pike's selection of supporting detail vividly suggests that he viewed the Nuevo Mexicanos as exotic rather than repugnant. One feature of El Gringo is that Davis is not consistently negative in his representation of New Mexico. My own interpretation is that he was conflicted by his personal responses versus the official position he was obliged to adopt on behalf of the interests of the U.S. government. Davis's most explicit treatment of race occurs in the section of his book titled Santa Fe, Manners and Customs. Okay. Okay, pardon me for technical difficulties. Davis's most explicit treatment of race occurs in the section of his book titled Santa Fe, Manners and Customs. He writes that the Nuevo Mexicanos lack the stability of character and soundness of intellect that gives such vast superiority to the Anglo-Saxon race over every other people. They have inherited a portion of the cruelty, bigotry, and superstition that have marked the character of the Spaniards from the earliest times. The ideology of Western expansion was predicated on a power hierarchy of Anglo-American dominance. Thus, as Homi Bhabha notes, the objective of colonial discourse is to construe the colonized as a population of degenerate types on the basis of racial origin in order to justify conquest and to establish systems of administration and instruction. The justifications for Anglo-American incursions were almost always tied to race, directly or implicitly, through a chain of assumptions perpetuated culturally and through the Anglo-American print media. Paredes's research shows us that the development of racist attitudes towards Mexicans can be traced back to the English literature of the 17th century. According to Paredes, unfavorable allusions to the tawniness and brownness of the Spaniards were common and resulted from their discomfort over the mixing of European and Moorish blood. To many of the English, he states, the Moors were simply Africans, which was to say black. The broader condition of Hispanophobia was born not only out of racism, but the additional factor of political rivalry between England and Spain as world powers, and England's rejection of Catholicism during the Reformation as an overly wealthy, complacent, and corrupt institution. The early Anglo colonists on the East Coast were loyal to their traditional beliefs towards the Spanish and were defensive towards their potential expansion. When transformed to the Americas, these prejudices were reinvigorated as a means of justifying what Doris Meyer describes as the Anglo-American zeal in expanding capitalism on the Western Front as the duty of a superior race with a regenerative function to perform. As with the anxiety regarding the intermixing of Spanish blood, the intermixing of Moorish blood, the introduction of American Indian blood through miscegenation was a principal concern. In one of his more scathing comments, Davis writes, "As would naturally be the case, a people so various in their origin as Mexicans, and in whose veins flow the blood of three distinct races, would present a corresponding diversity of character. They possess the cunning and deceit of the Indian, the politeness and spirit of revenge of the Spaniard, and the imaginative temperament and fiery impulse of the Moor." Note that the entire statement occurs in two parts. The first gives the appearance that Davis is making a rational claim that is relatively neutral ideologically. From a linguistic perspective, this first portion establishes what Culler describes as a logical presupposition, or the supposition that must be accepted in order to determine whether a statement is true or false. Functioning intertextually with the next sentence, it suggests that the context in which the next sentence is to be read. Having done that, the highly charged accusations that seem to follow seem to do so naturally. Like the strategy of comparison, logical presupposition is readily deployed. Note how it is incorporated into the following passage towards a somewhat different but related ideological effect. The new people who sprung from this intermarriage between the conquerors and the conquered were dark and swarthy in appearance, and so have remained through the change of generations for nearly 300 years. Among the present population, there is found every shade of color, from the nut brown, which exhibits a strong preponderance of the aboriginal blood, to the pure Castilian, who is slight and fair as the sons and daughters of the Anglo-Saxon race. The intermixture between the peasantry and the native tribes of Indians is yet carried on, and there is no present hope of people improving in color. In the passage above, Davis creates the presupposition with statements that are less neutral and more encoded in a way that will speak negatively to his Anglo-American audience. Framing his representation of the progeny of these people as a dark and corrupting influence upon the existing and more diverse population, he creates the necessary footing for the evaluative statement regarding no hope of improving their color. This final statement makes two presuppositions: that dark skin is undesirable, and that actions to increase the population's whiteness would be valuable. While this might seem to promote miscegenation rather than to discourage it, the prevailing attitude was that the Indian influence was enduring and difficult to breed out, much like the attitude that one drop of African blood was sufficient to taint the entire person. Another effective rhetorical strategy used during the colonial period was the use of polyphony by selecting and adopting the discourse style of genres that were considered inherently objective. Historiography and science were respected fields, and extensive replication of a given genre was not needed in order to satisfy the rhetorical needs of Davis's text. Scientific terms such as aboriginal or the use of male and female instead of men and women were interspersed in the text sufficiently enough to amplify the desired tone of objectivity. As dehumanizing as it was, this quasi-anthropological terminology was useful for all representations of the other, as demonstrated by Davis's basic description of the Mexicanos. In stature, they are below the medium height, both male and female, but are well made, with sound constitutions, and are graceful and athletic. The females exhibit, in some instances, the features of the Indian, high cheekbones and thick lips, but many of them possess considerable personal beauty. In this example, Davis demonstrates the desire to highlight the physical attributes that his readers might find valuable, particularly those suggesting that Nuevo Mexicanos would provide an attractive and sturdy workforce. The discourse of historiography was useful for another reason, the invocation of the omniscient narrator. Until recently, the all-knowing voice of historiographic narrative was an expected feature of the genre and helped provide the illusion that the observer could provide a complete account of the subject. In the semi-anonymous first half of El Gringo, Davis adopts the same authoritative voice in narrating his historiography of New Mexico. After stating his purpose to provide a sketch of leading historical incidents, the narration is virtually omniscient and is all the more believable when he tells his readers that the materials came from the official sources and the office of the Secretary of the Territory at Santa Fe, as if the representation were absolute rather than a matter of his selection. As a result, Davis's role in crafting the historical narrative becomes invisible, thus deflecting potential questions regarding his own objectives. Davis's credibility is enhanced by associating himself linguistically with the worlds of history and science, even if the connection is illusory. Okay. I'd like to conclude with some of the implications of this work for the present. Racialized representations of people of Mexican descent continue to support social inequality. We can look for examples in the media regarding the swine flu epidemic, immigration, and the continuing need of a Hispanic task force in the U.S. Senate. Also, there are considerable complexities regarding institutionalized racism. And as an example, I don't know if any of you noticed that the title of my paper was altered because the word gringo was filtered by the software of the state as being offensive language. When I looked on the Microsoft website, their description of the software is that Microsoft Antigen Server security protects security products help businesses protect their email and collaboration servers from viruses, worms, spam, and inappropriate content. And I think that this wording is interesting because the viruses, worms, and spam are all They're in a different category than inappropriate content. And the problem with the inappropriate content is that there isn't any type of accounting for how this selection occurs, who decides what content is inappropriate and how are those decisions made. And those are not, those decisions are being made, but the methods by which that is happening are not being made obvious. In closing, I'd like to present these last two quotes, one from Davis for his conclusion of El Gringo, and one is the opening phrase of the prospectus for El Payo, a newspaper that was published briefly in Santa Fe in 1845 by Jesus Maria Baca. Davis says, "I have endeavored to give you a faithful picture of New Mexico as it is now, with its vices and virtues. I have written nothing in malice because I have no such feelings to gratify, and my only desire is to present a correct knowledge of the country and its people. Some of the sketches show a dark picture in a moral point of view, but they are nevertheless true. Let us hope that a brighter day may soon dawn upon this distant and benighted portion of our happy land." And I think a good closing commentary on that is, the truth has never done as much good in the world as its appearance has done evil. So, do you have any questions, comments?
I had some comments just because I am a historian and I teach this part of American history.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to note that beyond the rhetorical threat, there was an actual execution of several people during the Taos Revolt in 1847. So if you're interested in the story.
No, that's why I say arguably. I didn't want to digress too much into that, but yeah, definitely. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So, I guess if I had one question, would be, how is what Davis presents unique for the time period? Because his scientific racialism, his hierarchy of people, is, I mean, why does this person capture you?
Okay.
And I know that's a hard question, but it's a good one for someone working on their dissertation.
Yeah. Okay, and in terms of my technical difficulties, I have not used this particular program before. There was something I missed, and maybe I can include that now. At the outset, Davis, as author, had to make choices concerning how he would incorporate his own identity into the narrative. Had he chosen to follow the path of earlier writers, he would have begun by revealing the personal circumstances and motivating reasons that led him to undertake the journey to Santa Fe. Not a minor issue considering the arduous nature of the journey, the month-long trip, and its inherent dangers. Davis chooses not to foreground his position and purpose as a U.S. attorney and instead begins the narrative in medias res as a traveler identified only by his name as the author on the title page. The first sentence reads, "I embark for the first time upon the great prairie sea that stretches through the central region of North America in the month of November 1853. Had this continued in a relatively brief portion of the text, it could be attributed to a stylistic choice. However, Davis's narrator remains without a personal context or stated purpose for more than half of the book, to page 246 when he's sworn into office. By disclosing his identity and name only, Davis can appear as the common man who preceded him, who represented their own interests rather than those of a nation." And basically, my thesis in an accompanying paper, the one that's going to appear on the website, is that El Gringo was a rhetorical Trojan horse. You know, it was seeming to be a travel narrative, and because that type of genre doesn't really elicit... when you read a travel narrative, your antennas don't go up. The red flag doesn't go up that you're going to, that it's a, what would you say, an opportunity for propaganda or for rhetoric. So this was something that was buried in the context of El Gringo. And that's what really makes it different, because when you look at these other narratives, Patty, for example, was, you know, they were traders. They were, and, you know, some were adventurers.
Mm-hmm.
No, no. And that's... He doesn't do it overtly. Well, he does, but the way that he does it is really interesting because he's constantly describing New Mexico. And in the way that he's doing that, he's taking on tremendous power because he's creating New Mexico for the people on the East Coast who have no direct experience. The only knowledge that they have of New Mexico and the people basically at that point is coming through travel writing.
So he's essentially saying his job is necessary by painting a picture of what's lacking? I'm trying to connect.
Well, yeah. You know, and he does, there is a brief, interestingly, the travel narrative portion of the book is very small. I would say it's maybe the last 25% of the book. The rest of it are chapters that are descriptions, like, let's say, of Santa Fe, his own iteration of the history of New Mexico, his own perceptions of the Pueblo Indians and so forth. And this is typical of that particular time period. Other books, it seemed like an obligatory way of presenting information, like because they were... not only describing their own personal experience, they were providing information for others that they felt obliged to, let's say, like have chapters like manners and customs. And you can see that in the table of contents of many of these books of a similar type.
Let me push that question a little bit.
Yeah.
Because with this classic book, that is why I really like your work, because it's a classic book that really influenced a great deal of policy in terms of how people were thinking of New Mexico at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would love to hear a little bit more of, and hopefully you include it in the dissertation, is why this individual, as a policymaker, effectively, because he is influencing policy legally,
mm-hmm.
right, in New Mexico. So what I would love to hear more is how he's influencing it. So I have written a little bit because he enters a debate about slavery and pilgrimage at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It deeply influences how people are thinking of that issue, which is coming up just at that time. But there are other policy issues that he intervenes in, right? So there is this context in which he enters. He's not any ordinary travel writer.
Mm-mm.
He's an attorney, right?
Yeah, he is.
And that power of the law also carries consequences.
And
so this, going on what Emma's point here, I think when you talk about power, the power, the rhetorical power, it's also with him, I think, tied with a legal power.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was a point I probably didn't make strongly enough in this. Yeah, essentially, he was not only a representative of the United States, but he was also imposing U.S. law. And he writes about riding the circuit, and in some of the other documents that I encountered, like, for example, the records like of his time as Secretary of the Territory, or as his time as interim governor, or his time as the U.S. attorney, that indicate that, you know, he was making decisions, life or death decisions. And also, one of the things that I didn't talk about in this was, and I know you know about this, Esteban, is the Michael Steck letter. When he was acting governor, he was corresponding with Michael Steck, who was an Indian agent in charge of the, I believe it was the Jicarilla Apache, in the south portion of the state. And he writes regarding what they were calling depredations, that if Michael Steck weren't able to basically get the Indians under control, to let them know that they would be wiped out. You know, he... you know, even though, and this is something that's really interesting, and I didn't go into this here, but the part of the rhetorical effectiveness of El Gringo is that it seems so beneficent. Aristotle writes about benevolence as one being one of the key ways that any speaker establishes ethos. You know, if you seem like you have a good attitude towards whatever topic it is or people that you're talking about, it goes a long way in promoting credibility. So he seems so beneficent. And part of the colonial attitude at that time was that this is all for your own good. you know, we're going to take your land away, and we're going to do all these things, but ultimately, you're going to benefit from it. You're going to be part of this great nation. And so when you look at this in this other context, and something that wasn't intended for public reading, the letter to Steck is very telling, you know, because in that, you know, he very clearly states that he will not, you know, he will go as far as genocide, really. If you talk about wiping out an entire tribe, you know, down to the last person, that's a form of genocide.
Let me ask another question.
Yeah.
So, how many other archival documents have you found of Davis writing at that time period that are not necessarily for public consumption, that are letters written to other public officials? And if you have a body of those, it would be really great to compare them. Is it the same Davis?
Yeah, you know, I have compiled some. One of the difficulties in terms of actually getting through the material is that his handwriting, and Beth knows a little bit about this. I actually made a typewritten transcript of a little diary that he made of going to Navajo country with the governor to make treaty with the Navajo. And it's interesting because the notes from that form the basis of the final two chapters of El Gringo, Trip to the Navajo Country. And you see the basic facts, you know, what Jordan, a speaker a couple of weeks ago, might have called history with, I guess it's a big S, big H or small H, you know, essentially what happened. You know, it's very factual, but by the time it gets into El Gringo, you know, there's a totally different, very rhetoricalized spin on the material. Yes?
Lovely. I wonder if in your research and your conversations with other scholars and researchers, have you found that people who do New Mexico history are familiar with that book? Because it seems to me that that a lot of people that do New Mexico history aren't really familiar with that particular book.
You know what's really...
And not many, I would think, have done a critical analysis of that book, whereby Charles Lemus has been sort of analyzed to death.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways, there's a similarity there. And not only in their descriptive sort of narrative, but also in their way of coming up, coining words that are catchphrases. And I also wonder if Stranger in a Strange Land was coined by him?
Oh, no. This is a biblical reference. It's highly intertextual.
Okay.
And I think, I looked that up at one point. It's, yeah. I think it might be Exodus or something like that. But yeah, your first question, though, is that I have not seen it discussed. And I think that the discourse analysis approach to history is very different. And this is one of the reasons why I appreciate the archives so much, is that a lot of materials that might not be a big deal in terms of what happened are very significant from a discourse perspective. So I'm so glad that at some point back in the past, somebody didn't decide, this isn't interesting, let's get rid of it. You know, you never know what scholars in the future, what kind of interest they're going to take in a certain type of material. So this discourse approach, I think, is fairly new in terms of analyzing history. And my own theory, and I'm digressing a little bit, discourse analysis is not really... there isn't much scholarship happening in the U.S. In Europe, it's happening because they are using discourse analysis as a way of making peace with their history, with Nazi Germany, with ongoing anti-Semitism, with lots of different problems. But in the U.S., we have never acknowledged our colonial past and the fact that we still are a colonial nation or colonizing nation. But our own personal national identity is so steeped in the fact that we're good guys, we're liberators, we don't colonize. You know, and that's absolutely not the case. But to get back to your question, other scholars have given El Gringo a lot of attention. Like, for example, Laura Gomez from the law school, she writes about El Gringo. It's been written about Genaro Padilla writes about El Gringo. They're briefly mentioned. But one of the things is that other than El Gringo, not a lot is known about Davis. And I was really, Nancy, the librarian here, helped me find master's thesis that was published, I think, in like 1946 about Davis that was not included in the Libros. You know, she knew that it was in the card catalog, so she was able to direct me to it. So once you start being able to create a greater historical personal context for Davis, it becomes really interesting because he was very ambitious. He came from a very well-connected family. He thought nothing of, let's say, writing a letter to James Buchanan and saying, you know, hey, let's have dinner. So there's so much personal context that I think is very relevant rhetorically, but that he manages to keep under the wire. And I would say, having read a lot of his writing in different contexts, that he's a very adroit rhetorician.
One question about the title. You know, he calls himself a gringo. Is he similar as a different person? Is he considering him as a judge there, as I am a gringo, I come here to? Well, I mean, that title has a lot of significance, but I don't know exactly.
I think that I've seen evidence. At times he appears to be self-effacing. I think that what he's trying to do is project himself through the eyes of the other. But he's really not doing it in a, you know, and El Gringo has a very, very mildly pejorative. I think, you know, I think even at that time it wasn't really pejorative, you know, in the sense that other words are. But he's... And sometimes in other writing, he seems like he feels like he really appreciates his own cleverness in some of these things, and they're really quite condescending.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It looks to me like even the title tends to already show a little bit of superiority.
Mm-hmm. Because he's othering himself while at the same time othering other people, but his underlying assumption. That U.S. supremacy, of Anglo supremacy, is never questioned. He's never really putting himself in the position of the other. It's like when people go to a new country, you know, there's the irony of expecting it to conform to the experience. And I see this happening with Americans all the time. They go someplace new and different, and then they complain about the strangeness.
Did he travel, you know, where is his past? Did he travel around, you know, other than the U.S.?
You know, later on in life, there's half of a more extensive memoir here. And I think, Beth, were you telling me that you think the other half is in the Beinecke Library at Yale? Yeah, okay, so it's divided up. Later on in life, he did go to Europe. He participated in an expo in Paris. I don't know, probably in the, like, 1880s or so. You know, so he did travel, but he was, you know, he was just very well-connected politically. He traveled around, he was a native of Pennsylvania. His family had been in the U.S. for something like 10 generations as of the writing. So they were like considered like the initial founding fathers and initial American elite.
Also, I'm also influenced by Pratt's observations about world travel writing, and I'm glad that you placed it in a larger context, all the way from the Agram, and it certainly can be earlier and some later, of those people who weren't up here but made these observations that sort of had this rhetorical power, including people like Atanasio Dominguez. Every year, the church officials had to make visitas, official visits, where they actually did accounting of the missions, but also included census records. But if you read someone like Atanasio Dominguez, he's making similar sort of interesting observations about class and race. So it may be interesting to see those observations in this larger picture, sort of like what you did, but then you jumped to Davis. In terms of people coming into the Southwest and observing issues of class and race and difference and all of them, there's a long trajectory. And I think it's really important not only to say that it's post-1848, it's actually well before that.
Right.
So people coming up to Mexico City, making these observations, as Atanasio Dominguez did, in his case, he says, it does not even compare to the crown jewel of something of my own Mexico City. So again, these differences, landscape, people, climate, all of that.
Yeah, you know, and what's interesting with that is, I think that would be fascinating because it might be, you know, to some extent a negative comparison, but it wouldn't have been fueled by the same rhetorical objective. You know, to see how that one specific rhetorical objective frames or influences how the descriptions are framed and really what they're seeing.
Just for the citation that you gave up here, my impression, you know, I haven't read anything about him or himself, but it gave me the impression that he had no really background about other races, you know. When he talks about the Spanish or the Indians, it doesn't look like he really knows.
No.
Why would he be an Indian? I mean, first of all, there's many Indians in the country, but it's very analyzing observations without real spaces.
Okay, no. Yeah. And this is another really interesting point of personal context. Davis was part of the invading forces with General Scott during the U.S.-Mexican War. So this undoubtedly must have influenced how he would think of Mexicans. You know, Susan.
I just kind of spot read in his book, but the one scene that I do remember is our back about gender, is the voluptuous, breast-dangling mestizo women. Is there much on our discussion of gender?
No, I haven't done a gender analysis per se, but that would be an interesting approach. He does. One of the things he does talk about is how, in such a singular way, the Navajo have such a egalitarian culture or society, with, you know, the women being equals with the men, and, you know, that the Navajo woman would never go saddle the horse of her husband, you know, that he would essentially do it himself, you know, and acknowledging that it was a matriarchal, more of a matriarchal society. But I know from reading letters between Michael Steck and his betrothed at the time that women's rights, there was a big issue over that. And my sense of, because Davis doesn't really write much about his wife, she just sort of is there, he marries her, and then everything else, he is always the center of focus. In El Gringo, when he accompanies the governor to, you know, on the trip to the Navajo country, it's all about him. He hardly acknowledges the governor at all. You know, and this is very typical of him. You know, there's one example, and this is part of that little diary. In a different time period, he refers to Governor Meriwether as His Excellency, with a capital E, you know, and in most of the other time, it's Governor with a little G. The governor, not mentioning his name or anything else. And, you know, later on, he felt like he was slighted, that he was not chosen to replace Meriwether when he left. I think Rencher was the next. And he attributed, his excuse for this, and this may be how he's trying to save his own image in his own mind, was that it was a political decision that the president at the time, I'm trying to think, Polk, wanted somebody to be governor who was going to be at least sympathetic with the Confederacy and Confederate interests, that there was quite a controversy then of whether New Mexico would become a slave state. So that the Rencher was put in because he was sympathetic to Texan influences or Texan interests as well as those of the Confederacy. So, you know, he went back to Pennsylvania and started a newspaper. And from that point, one of the things that I'd like to find more information about is what did he say about New Mexico from his newspaper in Pennsylvania?
Well, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.